Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Hello, everybody. This is Jim Dolan, your host for this week on the RTC Weekly Download. Now we're going to listen to Orson Welles as he does his Harry Lime program and Rogue's Holiday from 1951. And then after that, it's an episode of Behind the Mic on versatile acting. So I thought that since we're having Orson Welles, versatile acting might be a good subject for that show, too. So here we go with Harry Lime.
Presenting Orson Welles as The Third Man. The Lives of Harry Lime. The fabulous stories of the immortal character, originally created in the motion picture The Third Man, with zither music by Anton Karas.
That was the shot that killed Harry Lime. He died in a sewer beneath Vienna. As those of you know who saw the movie The Third Man, yes, that was the end of Harry Lime. But it was not the beginning. No. He had many lives. And I can tell you about all of them. How? Because my name is Harry Lime.
Did I ever tell you about the time when I outwitted three very suspicious Wall Street investors at a net profit to yours truly of 55,000 American dollars? No? Well, I will sometime. Anyway, because of that little caper, I decided that an ocean trip would be good for my nerves and for the nerves of some half dozen New York detectives. And that's how I happened to go on a holiday. A rogue's holiday, if you will.
As Harry Lime, the third man in Rogue's Holiday.
Very pleasant. Day or so out of New York, aboard the Queen Anne, bound for Southampton. I was on the passenger list as J. Harrington Lime. I ate, of course, at the captain's table, remembering how I put the investments of those three Wall Street brokers in my own personal piggy bank. Whenever I was asked,
"And what business are you in, Mr. Lime?"
I would smile to myself and answer, "I'm an investment broker, Lady Barbara. It is the Lady Barbara Folliot, isn't it?"
"Yes, of course."
"I thought we'd met. Aren't you also sitting at the captain's table?"
"Yes, that's right."
"And I seem to remember that there's an empty chair at the table next to yours. You're not traveling alone?"
It's of no importance. You are on a holiday, Mr. Lyne?"
"A holiday? After a manner of speaking, yes."
"I don't understand."
"I'm so interested in my work, Lady Barbara, that I'm seldom able to keep from mixing pleasure and business."
"Oh, you seem so young to be engaged in so complex a business. Investment banker."
"Mm.
I always thought all bankers were portly men in their 50s.
"Oh, every banker must be able to inspire confidence in his clients, Lady Barbara. The incompetent banker relies on his appearance and his maturity."
"And you?"
"I rely on my record of success, ma'am." "No hurry. No hurry at all. Not while I was on my holiday. Pleasant boat, Queen Anne, scheduled to take 6 days to Southampton, she was. I had plenty of time.
And the question of Lady Barbara Folliot's bank account and the question of the empty chair next to it, the captain's table, preyed a bit on my mind, so I looked at the passenger list. There she was, all right. Lady Barbara Folliot, stateroom A deck, stateroom for two, right now. All it said was, and companion. And companion, what did that mean? Not a husband, surely. Looked up the steward for a stateroom. Steward, you're in charge of the staterooms along this corridor, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
Now, number six, I believe that's Lady Barbara Folliot's stateroom, isn't it?
I believe so.
I was wondering, just idle curiosity, you know, on the passenger list, she's down as traveling with a companion. But he doesn't say who the companion might be.
He don't, sir.
Steward.
Yes, sir.
Here, take this for your trouble.
Thank you.
Now then, would you tell me who her companion is?
No, sir. Not me, sir. Will that be all?
Just a minute now.
Yes,
sir. After all, old man, I slipped you a $10 bill just for a bit of information.
The lady in question, sir, slipped me a double sawbuck not to give out that information, sir.
A double sawbuck?
$20, sir.
Ah, yes. Well, then, I'll just take this for your trouble.
Thank you,
now,
sir.
Now then, about Lady Barbara's companion.
You were planning a little anky-panky, no doubt, sir.
Hanky panky.
Worried, were you, sir, lest the companion might be the husband of the lady in question?
Yes, something like that, yes.
Looking for a little shipboard romance, no doubt, sir.
That's it. Now, who's the companion?
You've got clear sailing, sir. The companion's not her husband. Matter of fact, take my advice and wait till the companion's got her sea legs, sir. A lot cuter, the companion, than Lady Barbara, sir.
Thank you, Stuart.
Not at all, sir.
So, in the next day or so, I found opportunities for squiring Lady Barbara around the boat, cocktails in the evening, a drink or two after dinner, even a game or two of deck tennis in the afternoon. Something she'd said made me prick up my ears and redouble my attentions to her as a prospective, shall I say, client. We were having brandy in the lounge after dinner.
The other day, Mr. Lyon...
Yes?
You were saying that what you relied on to inspire your clients with confidence...
Was my continuing success, yes, that's right.
I must say, you inspire me with confidence.
Well, that's half the battle for an investment banker like me. Have you some problem with your own investments?
To be frank, yes, I have, Mr. Lyon. We must talk of it further tomorrow.
Well, why not now?
Thank you, I should like to, but the truth is, I must spend...
Your companion, the reason for the empty chair next to you at the table. Hmm?
Yes, I...
She hasn't her sea legs yet, hmm?
How did you know it was she, not he? Well, it's no matter. You'll probably be meeting her tomorrow. If she takes a liking to you, Mr. Lyme, as I have, then perhaps we can do some business. That is, if you want to.
Well, anyway, I can be of service, Lady Barbara. Next morning, I ran into their steward, and he told me that both ladies were out promenading. With some caution, I went looking for them. True, I was on holiday, but still, if I could turn my hand to a piece of business. Besides, I was curious about this mysterious companion whose name was not even carried on the passenger list. Turning a corner on the promenade deck, I nearly bumped into them. Quickly, I ducked back behind a bulkhead as they passed. I'm not Frances. So, her companion was a princess, For the rest, I'd seen that she wore a veil close over her hair and face, but no veil could conceal that beauty, and I'd seen something else that interested me, too. A string of pearls, matched pearls. I maneuvered into position for the next round on the promenade. Lady Barbara!
Oh, good morning, Mr. Lyon. Anne, this is the nice man I told you about who's been so kind to me. Mr. Lyon, this is Miss Jones.
How do you do, Mr. Lyon? I am pleased to meet you.
Miss Jones? Such an ordinary name for such an extraordinary young lady.
He makes nice speeches, Barbara, just as you said he did.
Perhaps you'll permit me to join you?
Oh, I'm so sorry. We were just going in, Mr. Lyon. Weren't we, Barbara?
Well, then at least, Miss Jones, maybe you will join me and Lady Barbara this evening before dinner.
Mr. Lyon insists on the practice of buying me a cocktail before dinner, Anne.
Why, I should like that. Only, as to cocktails, the ship's doctor told me that perhaps until I am stronger, I should drink champagne.
Perfect. I'll make sure there's a bottle nice for you, Miss Jones. Sure that while that name Jones was a phony, the pearls weren't. This was promising to become one of the more profitable holidays I'd spent. That evening, I was in the lounge early, a bucket of iced champagne by my side.
Mr. Lyon, as you promised, my wine.
It's vintage, Miss Jones. I think it should be adequate. No, Lady Barbara?
Oh, she was a little indisposed. She sent her regards.
Please sit down. Stuart,
I confess, Miss Jones, I'm not too sorry Lady Barbara's not joining us tonight.
So?
I was looking forward so to meeting you. You'd become a lady of mystery, and having met you this morning on the promenade deck, I spent the day looking forward to chatting with you.
Oh, more pretty speeches.
all right, sir?
Yes, fine. Fine, thank you. If the wine meets with Miss Jones' approval.
Miss Jones knows little of wines, Mr. Lyon. She is content to leave such matters to you. You have won Lady Barbara's confidence, and that means that you have won mine, too.
Then a toast to your improved health, Miss Jones.
Now, why do you always pause, as if you do not remember my name?
Oh, my apologies. Very rude of me. I'm awfully sorry.
I accept your... Oh!
What is it?
Oh, my string of necklaces. It broke. Oh, my pearls.
Oh, here.
Pearls.
Here, look out. Just hold still. You know how many of them there were? Now, don't move.
Yes, there were 64.
Just so we can make sure none of them have rolled under... here. Yeah, here's another.
Such a stupid thing. No, I really must have...
Please, here's another. Steward.
No, it is all right. I think that's all of them. Let me see. Quickly, that's 5, 10, 15.
Yes. Just hang on a second, will you? The lady's string of pearls broke. Maybe that one or two are still missing.
Oh,
somewhere.
I have never done such a bit. Oh. Such a foolish thing. 55 and 5 is 60 and 1, 2, 3... Four. Yes, that is a whole lot of them. Thank you, Stuart.
Lucky thing, ma'am.
Oh, Mr. Lyle, do me a great favor.
Anything at all. I say you're sure they're all here.
Oh, yes, sure. Take them, will you? You have an envelope, perhaps, or a safe pocket. Take them for me to the little jewelry shop. You know the one right on the stairs.
Oh, sure, I know the shop. But
maybe it's still open. You can have the man restring them properly on a strong new string. Would you do that?
Well, I'm not sure I like the idea, really, of wandering around the ship with a handful of loose pearls. These look like the real thing.
No, they will be perfectly safe. Now, won't you, for me, such a little favor, if the shop should still be open, please?
Leave you?
Oh, I shall sit here quite quietly, just thinking how lucky I am that you were with me when the string broke, until you return. All right?
All right. I'll be back as soon as I can.
Orson Welles returns in just a moment as the third man. Now, Orson Welles as the third man continues with Rogue's Holiday.
So there I was, by myself, free as the wind, with 64 pearls in my pocket. Even one of them, one of the bigger ones, would be worth, well, £5,000, something like that. Nice sum. My stateroom, I had some loose pearls, paste. I could have made the switch easily enough, had plenty of time. And a stupid thief might have done just that. But not Harry Lyon. Oh, no. I'd play it smart. I'd wait till later. Went straight to the ship's jeweler.
String broker?
If you could do a quick but good repair job, old man, I'd be most grateful.
Oh, it's easy enough. Just take a moment. Just roll them out here. Good ones, aren't they?
Well, they look it, don't they?
Yes. To an expert's eye, they're very handsome indeed.
How much would you estimate that string to be worth, old man?
If you were to just walk into this shop and ask to buy them, or if you wanted me to find you another 64 like...
No, just walk in and buy them. £50,000?
Oh, I'd say this string closer to
£150,000,
sir.
Well, I was a pretty rich man there for a few minutes.
There you are, sir.
Yes.
That string shouldn't break very quickly.
Thank you very much. What do I owe you?
Oh, forget it, sir. It's a privilege to be handling those pearls, even if only for a moment.
It would have been foolish for me to tamper with his fortune while we were still aboard ship. 2 days we'd be in Southampton, at which there'd be still plenty of time. The important thing was to get this lovely girl's confidence, which I most certainly did. And the second thing was to pry under her incognito. Who was she? Which princess of the blood was anxious to conceal her identity under the plebeian name of Jones? And why? Not until the last night when the ship was gliding into the soft darkness past Plymouth, when the two of us stood under a sickle moon on the boat deck, did I find out. If she looked lovely in that moonlight, her pearls looked even lovelier.
Oh, the wonderfully soft warm night.
I hadn't noticed.
You had not? Oh, the band has begun playing again.
Yes?
Can't you hear it? What's the matter with you?
I need all my five senses for something more important than looking at nights or listening to dance plans.
No, Mr. Lyme.
Harry.
Harry, you must know.
If the night is warm, it's because it must be. To afford you a warm mantle. If the band is playing, it's only to provide a setting for your voice. Miss Jones.
My name is...
Yes?
Anne.
Don't move.
Please.
What price the warmth of the night or the music of the band?
Oh, you kiss very expertly, Mr.
Harry.
Or should I say you seem very practiced.
If a cat may look at a king...
Yes?
Then perhaps it's all right. If I kiss a princess...
You will not like me.
I knew you were a princess, not your name, if that matters.
You are uncanny, Mr. Lyme.
Harry.
Since you have gotten this far and since you have shown yourself trustworthy, I can see no reason for not telling you anymore. I am Anne de Bourbon, Princess of Helwigstein.
At your service, ma'am.
You have heard of our principality? It is in Eastern Germany. Beyond the Iron Curtain. I should say it was this no more. It's all gone except...
Except what?
I'm not sure. I will not know until I meet my husband in London. If I meet my husband.
If? There's some doubt.
I have said too much already, Mr. Lyme. It is too bad. It has been a pleasant evening. I was almost able to forget for a moment. Good night.
She was gone, just like that. At least I knew now who she was. Whether I'd be able to find her again in London, whether I'd frightened her away, and whether my chance with that string of pearls by letting her know that I knew she was a princess, all these things I was a little nervous about. Till next day, just as I was getting ready to disembark in Southampton, Lady Barbara came up to me rather quickly.
Mr. Lyme, here, a note.
A note from...
Read it, please.
After last night, I've been worried for fear I might just possibly have said something which, you know, might have offended your friend, Miss Jones.
Offended her? Oh, read the note.
The note paper bore a crest to Colin Mansfield's, one sheet of heavy paper folded once. There was no salutation. The note said, as you said, a cat may look at a king. It might be interesting and fun to experiment once more with your other statement, the one about a princess. There was no signature. But none was necessary.
Do you feel better?
Yes, but...
She asked me to tell you that we would be stopping at the Carlton. We'll hope to see you then.
So she had arranged that we should meet again after all. But when we met again, away from the dangerous confines of an ocean liner, I proposed to relieve her lovely neck of those lovely pearls. I'm sure I was on a holiday and sentiment was involved, but these were factors that had to be disregarded. My scheme was foolproof. As it turned out, the scheme wasn't needed. The first time I saw her in the sitting room of her Carlton suite.
Mr. Lyme.
No.
All right, Harry. Harry, you have already done me one favor. I hate to ask you,
I've
but...
told you I'm at your service, Miss Jones.
No, call me Anne, please. Yes. If you want me, Highness, I shall be... No, don't leave, Barbara. Stay with us. You know the favor I have to ask of Harry anyway.
I started to say anything short of murder, Anne.
No, it's nothing like that. First, listen. On shipboard, you remember, I told you I was to meet my husband.
If, you said.
Yes, if. This is the if. Years ago, Harry, when the Red Army was driving through East Germany, we had to flee. My husband ate what was valuable that we had. Jewels, some gold plate, a pitiful collection, really. But all we had. He hid it himself. He alone knew where it was. He trusted in those days no one. Then, a few weeks ago, we planned to get it back. It would cost us a lot, we knew. Bribes, the purchase of a plane, fee for the pilot, more bribes and always more bribes. Klaus had to fly into Helwigstein, don't you see, himself. Mad and dangerous idea.
I think so.
But he refused to tell anyone else where his cachet was. He could not trust anyone. I went to America to raise some funds that was needed.
Mm.
Lady Barbara has been good enough to lend us more. But just today, I have learned that even more is needed.
More money?
Mr. Lyon, say no quickly if you cannot do me this favor. But I have exhausted all my other resources. If you knew how much it costs to bribe these officials over here.
Oh, I bet. How much do you need?
Oh, you will do it? It's just a loan, mind you.
It's a pleasure.
Lady Barbara's investment will bring her all we need at the first of the next quarter, and then I can repay you.
Please, how much do you need?
$10,000. It is too much?
I don't think so. No, certainly not.
And see, for security. Security on your loaner here. You will take this. My pearls. You have already once guarded them well.
Oh, please, I wouldn't dream of...
Yes, I insist. Otherwise, I will not even ask you for the loan of the $10,000.
Oh, well, if you insist.
Here, take them. Now, how can we arrange to get the money?
Well, I have more than that here in the hotel safe in American dollars, too. Just let me ring the desk. A trip downstairs in the lift. Elevator to you, back up again to my room and over to hers. I handed her 10 bills. She handed me the pearls. We smiled, shook hands on the deal, and I walked out of her room with a fortune in my pocket. Call for a celebration. Pal of mine runs a pub saloon to you in London. I use it as a sort of message sender. I have letters sent me there. My pal knows all the gossip who's in town, who swindled whom, all the news. I need my business, so I went straight to him.
Harry, I haven't seen you for months.
Afternoon, Barney. Give me a whiskey and soda, double whiskey and soda. None of your bar whiskey. There's something good. One for yourself. I'm celebrating.
So am I, man. So am I. I'm celebrating your return.
Well, good.
How long have you been in England?
Just a little while.
Too hot for you in the States, was it?
Look, can we have a drink somewhere in private?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Follow me. Got onto something good, have you?
I'll be leaving London pretty quick, Barney. I should go to Europe, France, I guess maybe Italy.
Well, you've only just got here.
I pulled a quick one. They may be looking for me in London sooner than I like to think.
Uh-huh. What for? Unless it's something you think I should know about.
Look, Barney.
Well, now, aren't they beauties? Real thing, aren't they?
I had them priced by a jeweler who said he'd ask £150,000 for them.
Oh, that should keep you in cigarettes for a week or two. Not bad.
Not bad at all.
Not half bad. Not, in fact, a quarter better. Let me have a look. Do you mind?
Look them over all you want, Barney. I'll fence them in Paris somewhere. This is your last look, old man.
Uh-huh. Where did you say you got them?
Off a German princess. She gave them to me as a security on a loan.
Mm-hmm. German princess, is it?
Yes, French-born, I think.
French-born, you think?
Yes.
Name of what?
Anne de Bourbon, princess of Elvigstein.
Oh.
Yes, very good. What's so funny? What's so very funny?
Anne de Bourbon, princess of Elvigstein.
All right, old man, all right. Better let me in on the joke.
I thought these pearls looked funny. Although you said they weren't gem.
You're crazy. Well, Barney, I had them priced myself.
Maybe you had some pearls priced, but not these. But boy, you've been Ed. The oldest trick in the world. Pulled on you, Harry Lyme.
Now, you're lying. Now, don't try to pull your tricks on me, Barney. A joke's a joke. But...
Oh, I don't have to. It's been pulled already. Harry, me bucko, I know who Andy Bourbon is. I know who the Princess von Elwigstein is, too. She's a slick little article.
Oh, no.
But she ain't German. She's not French-born, and I don't think you'll ever find any Elwigstein on no map. She's Doris Jones.
Oh.
That's who she is. And she was born right here in Clapham. That's where she was born. And she took you and shook you for, how much?
I gave her 10,000 American dollars. I don't believe you.
I'll die. The oldest gag in the world and pulled on none other than Harry Lyme himself. I'll die.
Room 316, please.
Harry, when this news gets around, boy...
That's right, I'm calling Miss Jones. No, never mind. Oh.
Well, do I win me bet? And did you lose your 10,000 American dollars?
Yes. Oh, I've got these pearls.
Oh, better than nothing, Gary. It's a good imitation. Must be worth 50 pounds.
50 pounds? Well, I'm on my holiday. I come out ahead after all.
What? Well, what about your 10,000 American dollars?
Your slick little article from Clapham tries to pass that 10,000, Barney. They're counterfeit. That'll teach Miss Jones. to try anything fast with Harry Lyme.
Harry Lyme returns in just a moment.
Seems that Miss Jones found herself a legitimate prince, one of those exiles in Portugal, and settled down with him in Lisbon. I ran into her at Estoril a couple of seasons later. She was a real princess now. But it seems His Highness isn't as young as he was and probably never was, so the princess is very democratic. She asked me to their place for dinner, said she thought I'd be interested in some of the interior decorations. I was. She complimented me on my nice set of pearl studs, which she recognized, and showed me into the cloakroom, which was entirely wallpapered in American $10 bills, or a reasonable facsimile. I recognized them. No hard feelings, you understand. It's a pleasant little caper, and I always enjoy moving about amongst the upper classes. It's so educational. Well, goodbye for now. Don't take any lead nickels. And remember, if you can't manage to resist temptation, be sure you get it appraised.
This next program took you behind the mic to see how broadcasting was done. And it's from 1940, and it's called Versatile Acting.
Radio's own show, Behind the Mic. Radio. With a switch of a dial, radio brings you tragedy, comedy, entertainment, information, education, a whole world at your command. But radio isn't all on the surface. There are stories behind radio, stories behind your favorite program and favorite personalities and radio people you never hear of. Stories as amusing, dramatic, and as interesting as any make-believe stories you hear on the air. And that's what we give you. The human interest, the glamour, the tragedy, the comedy, and information that are behind the mic. And now, presenting a man whose name, since the beginning of broadcasting, has been a byword in radio, Graham McNamee.
Thank you, Gil Martin. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen of the radio audience. Behind the Mic presents one of the most versatile character actors in radio. When a radio director is casting a show and he wants a man who can play a Scotchman in one part of the show and a pack of wolves in another, he probably hires our next guest. You might have heard him as the villain on the Dick Tracy program one night and as a funny voice on the Fred Allen show another. As a matter of fact, he plays so many parts that I suggest you be mighty careful about swatting a moth in your closet. It just might be Charlie Cantor. Charlie, exactly what kind of dialects do you do?
Well, Monsieur McNamee, I can do a French dialect like this if you prefer. I can also play the part of a blooming cockney from East 10 with pearl buttons. And if you don't like that, well, doggone, bless my ass britches from Memphis, I can stand here with my bare feet hanging out and talk like this here.
But I can talk a little like I've just been kissing the Blarney Stone.
Maybe you like a little Italian, Bazan, eh, like this? Then I can play the Scotchman, like the Scotchman who went to the dentist and asked how much to pull my tooth. And the dentist says $2, and the Scotchman said, okay, here's a buck, just loosen it.
And Charlie, I suppose you speak English, too.
My friend, you're asking, so I'm telling. You can take everything away, but don't take away my Yankee accent.
You not only do dialects, but you also play those two popular little characters on the Fred Allen show.
You mean the dopey man who talks something like this, yeah.
And the little man who talks way up here like this, yeah.
Yes, I do, Graham.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, Charlie, we had a man on this program who impersonates animals.
Yeah, what does he do with animals?
Impersonates animals, Charlie. Do you also impersonate animals?
Well, yes, Graham, for comedy purposes. For instance, on one program, I was called upon to do a lovesick chicken, which sounded something like this. And once I was called upon to do a parrot, which sounded something like this.
Hello, buddy, 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 buddy. Hello.
Another week, I was called upon to do a hen laying an egg, and it sounded something like this.
I wonder how a program sounds when it lays an egg, Charlie.
Well, I hope I never find out.
Besides playing dialects and characters on shows, what other unusual things do radio directors call upon you to do?
Well, lots of things, Graham. For instance, I'm generally called upon to do funny laughs. One show, I had to do the laugh of a man who was looking over the shoulder of another man who was reading the funnies in the subway, and as the paper doesn't belong to him, it was a sort of a repressed laugh, like this. Then there's the timid laugh that I have to do at times like this. And then, still another comedy show, I had to do a laugh like a man who was waiting outside of the delivery room in a hospital. His wife is expecting a baby. The nurse comes out and tells him it's a boy. Also a girl. Another boy.
Oh. Folks, when I said he was versatile, I wasn't kidding. Charlie, just out of curiosity, did you have any theatrical experience before you got into radio?
Well, Graham, I've been in radio 11 years, but I did play in vaudeville for quite some time. When I was in school...
High school?
Well, I won't say it was college, but my brother was a vaudevillian, and he had a comedy act. During the summer, he used to fire his straight man, and I'd substitute for his straight man for 8 weeks, and in that way, make my school tuition expenses for the whole year. And do you know who the first straight man my brother fired to make room for me was?
No, who?
Archie Leach, who is now better known as Cary Grant.
So Cary Grant was fired so you could take his place.
That's right, Graham.
Well, is there any chance of RKO doing that to Cary now?
No. I wouldn't let him, Graham. Gosh, I wouldn't let him railroad me into that.
No.
I'd hate to play those mushy love scenes opposite Loretta Young or Myrna Loy or Hedy Lamarr.
Oh.
No, 1,000 times no.
All right, Keeper, I'll come quietly.
Thank you, Charlie Cantor. Oddities in Radio. Presenting odd little true stories that help make radio sometimes amusing, sometimes exasperating, but always interesting to the people in it. Oddity number one. A few years ago, newscaster Mark Hawley was master of ceremonies on a program for a shoe account emanating from Buffalo. The commercial announcement was done by two women, Mrs. Miller and Mrs. Johnson, who talked over the back fence about things pertaining to shoes. One day, the time of the broadcast was changed. Through sheer forgetfulness, the two women who did the commercials were not notified. Hawley and his announcer didn't realize this until just before the show, and nothing could be done. When they came to the commercial, there was only one thing to do, and the announcer and Hawley did it. They slipped into falsetto and...
How are you this morning, Mrs. Miller?
Oh, I'm so glad to see you, Mr. Johnson.
Oh, yeah, how's the family?
Oh, everybody's fine except little Willie. His corns are bothering him, and he's got arch trouble.
Oh, he has?
Yes.
Well, you know, George Jr. had the very same trouble, and we found the most wonderful shoes.
That's
They're
so.
Simply marvelous.
They went on and on. After the broadcast was over, Hawley, worried to death, got a phone call from the sponsor.
Yes? Yes, well, I can explain.
I want to know who those two women were.
Well, they were just two women who we called in because, well, we were in an emergency and...
Well, they were terrific. Get rid of those two regular women and we'll hire them.
Oddity number two. Years ago in the early days of radio, when NBC was still at 711 Fifth Avenue instead of its present palatial quarters at Radio City, radio was not quite the almost perfect technical thing it is today. For instance, in those days, there was no emergency lighting system. And if the lights in the studio went out, the studio was dark until the lights were fixed. For a few brief seconds, we take you back to those early days of radio when there was an unwritten rule that if the lights went out when an orchestra was playing, the orchestra would perform Dixie, because that was the one number all the boys could play together without looking at their music. Well, one day, Frank Black was conducting his orchestra and the lights went out at the finish of a number. Instead of the next regularly scheduled selection, the orchestra went into... At the finish of Dixie, the studio lights were fixed and the orchestra resumed its regular program. Suddenly, the lights went out again. And that's exactly what happened. All I can say is, if that ever happened to our orchestra leader here, Ernie Watson, he'd drop dead. Oddity number three. A few weeks ago, Samuel Kaufman, radio feature writer, hailed a taxi.
Hey, cab. Take me downtown to the New York Sun. Know where it is?
I know all the ways to get there.
Oh, you do, eh? Well, take me the short way.
Say, buddy, you got a radio back there. What do you say you turn it on?
No, thanks. I don't want to hear the radio.
Well, maybe you don't, but I do.
Oh, I see. Well, where do you want me to turn it?
You turn the dial, I'll tell you. Yeah, that's right, right there. Now turn on the juice.
Just a moment. And pop my curiosity. But who do you want to listen to?
A guy I never miss, Uncle Don.
And for those of you who don't know Uncle Don, Uncle Don conducts a well-known kiddie program. Thank you, Sam Kaufman. You played the part of yourself to perfection. show favorites, favorite food. In the upper reaches of New York's theatrical district, where actors are legion, Schubert is king, and Damon Runyon and Walter Winchell are court chroniclers, there is a restaurant which has become as much of a habit with some of your favorite radio stars as worrying about their Crosley ratings. And for no particular reason, we thought you listeners might be interested in some of the food habits of your radio favorites and what they eat. So we have brought you the man who can best give you this information, the proprietor of Lindy's, New York's famous restaurant, Leo Linderman, or Lindy himself. Lindy, suppose you start telling us about the food habits of the famous radio personalities who put on the feed bag in your restaurant.
Who would you like to hear about, Graham? Oscar Levant?
Yes. What is Oscar Levant's favorite food?
Well, Graham, I think it must be coffee, because when he comes into my restaurant, he will drink at least 10 cups.
That's probably what keeps him so wide awake on information, please.
Then do you know what he likes to do? He likes to steal cookies and macaroons out of the cake box.
Naughty, naughty, Oscar. One more swiped cookie and Papa will take away your encyclopedia, Britannica. I can't say encyclopedia Britannica. Did you know, sir? Well, how about some other favorites? Say, Eddie Cantor.
Well, Eddie is crazy about well-done hamburgers. He generally starts his dinner with a little dry sherry, and then he's very fond of bologna and eggs.
Well, when he comes into your restaurant, does he eat by himself?
Oh, no. Eddie is crazy about company. He generally comes in with his wife, Ida, and a party of 10 or 12 people. How would you like to hear about Jack Benny?
Yes, I would. Because if eating has anything to do with the salary Jack makes, I'm going to change my diet.
Then you better start eating lots of fish. Jack's favorite seems to be sturgeon and Nova Scotia salmon sandwiches. And for dessert, he has...
Yes, I know that product he advertises.
Boynton Allen also like all kinds of fish.
Well, how about a real gourmet, like Paul Whiteman?
He's not a gourmet anymore. He used to love rich foods.
You mean the days when he was known as two sleepy people?
Yes, but that was before he went on his diet. Now when he does come in, which is very seldom, he eats things like boiled steak, a lamb chop, gluten bread, and for dessert, stewed fruit without sugar.
So that's how Paul keeps his schoolgirl figure, eh?
Yes, Walter Winchell has a pretty heavy appetite for a thin man. Because of his work, he generally eats dinner about 2 o'clock in the morning. He always asks if there's anything left over from dinner, and he will have that. He likes all egg dishes and fish, and like Eddie Cantor, he's a bologna and egg feed. He's also very fond of conversation of marinated herring.
Lindy, I think we have just about time for one more celebrity diet.
What about J. Edgar Hoover? He makes radio speeches once in a while.
Well, that's kind of stretching a point. But just out of curiosity, what is J. Edgar Hoover's favorite fodder?
He likes raw meat and lots of it.
Uh-oh. Well, the next time I pass him, if I find myself without an arm, I'll know what happened. But thank you, Lindy. Thank you very much for the fodder falder of... behind how a cab driver became a successful radio and Broadway show writer. Recently, a new musical comedy hit came into Broadway to the applause of the critics. The show was Hold On to Your Hats, and it starred Al Jolson. One of those responsible for the funny book of the show is a fellow named Eddie Davis, who for the last few years has been very successful as a radio writer. But before Eddie Davis got into radio... Oh, but here he is, and we'll let Eddie tell it himself. Eddie Davis. Eddie, before we go into the start of your career, will you please tell the audience who are some of the radio comedians for whom you've written?
Well, for 6 years, I was one of Eddie Cantor's writers. He gave me my start in radio. Then I also written for Al Jolson, Ed Wynn, Jack Haley, Joe Penner, Milton Berle, and many others.
Mm-hmm. What did you do before you started writing for radio?
Graham, I used to drive a cab, and believe it or not, that cab actually helped me to get my first radio job.
How was that, Eddie?
Well, it was about 8 years ago. You see, between 8 and 9 in the evenings, I used to park my cab in front of the New Amsterdam Theater. In those days, Eddie Cantor was doing his broadcast there. I used to listen to the Cantor program and write down the jokes I thought he should have used on the show. Then right after the show, I'd go upstairs and see Eddie and tell him those jokes. Most of them were pretty punk. He wouldn't use them, but I kept right on trying. After giving him the jokes, I'd wait downstairs and drive him home. One night I parked my cab in front of the New Amsterdam Theater, listened to Eddie Cantor's broadcast, and I hurried upstairs to the studio and I...
Wait a minute, buddy. The only people who can get through this corridor are the actors on the show.
Listen, you're new around here, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
Then you don't know me. I'm Mr. Cantor's chauffeur. I just want to tell him where his car is parked.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Hello, Mr. Cantor.
So I says to the guy, how do you like that guy? Oh, hello, Davis. Say, look, you mind telling me just one thing? How were you able to pass the man at the door to get in here?
Just personality, Mr. Cantor. Plain place. But nevertheless, I got a joke I wanted you to do tonight.
Yeah?
Look, you could open up the program by saying, Jimmy, what do you think? This morning I opened up my closet and find a little Mort crying. And Jimmy says, wait a minute, who ever heard of a Mort crying? And you could say, well, didn't you ever hear of a Mort ball?
Well, maybe I could use something like that.
Look, I got another one you could abuse. You could use it next week. You open the program, you say, Jimmy, what does NBC stand for? And Wallington says, National Broadcasting Company. And you say, how do you like that? And all the time I thought it was nothing but Cantor.
Well, that's not bad. Look, just on the chance I might be able to use it, Eddie, here's a little something for yourself.
Can you imagine? I saw look back to Cantor. Me, Eddie Davis, a cab driver. I'm selling jokes to Cantor. I gotta go before I faint.
Look, where are you going?
I gotta phone my wife. Helen, do you hear that? Tell the baby, Evelyn. I saw look back to Cantor. How do you like that?
Wait a second. Maybe you can sell some more jokes to Cantor. I'm doing a routine on daylight saving time next week. I want some jokes on watches. You think you could write a couple?
A couple? I'll write 100. I'll write 1,000,000. Say, give me a nickel. I want to phone my wife. I saw look at... I'm so excited. I don't know what I'm saying, really.
Wait. You haven't written them yet. Gonna be waiting for me downstairs and drive me home?
Am I? You're gonna be driven like you never was driven before.
All right, Eddie, take me home.
Okay, Mr. Cantor. Say, I've been thinking about those gags. You know, you told me to write for next week. You know, the ones about the watches.
Look, Eddie, I'm a nervous man. I've got a wife and 5 children. Just as a favor to Cantor, please don't turn around when you talk.
All right. But look, about those watch gags. Suppose you were to come on a stage with a watch hanging out in the back of your pocket. And Wellington was to say, Eddie, what have you got that watch hanging out in the back pocket for? And you say, I can't help it. I'm behind times, Jimmy. You like that?
Hey, look out for that truck!
Why don't you look where you're going, you big baloney?
I'll flatten you.
Yeah? You and who else? I've got Cantor in my cab. I'll have him take a poke at it. Go ahead, Cantor. Show him how you fight.
Listen,
go ahead.
Davis, listen, I'm a comedian, not a prize fighter.
That's the trouble with the cab business these days. These truck drivers think they own the street. Say, I got another watch gag. You could bring out a watch and show it to Wellington and say you call it your wool wipe watch because it's always 5 to 10. You like that? 5 to 10.
Where are you going?
Just scrape his fender a little bit and he puts up a big yell. How do you like a guy
Listen,
like that?
Listen, Davis, as a personal favor to my wife, my 5 children, and my sponsor, will you please keep your eyes on the road?
I'm keeping my eyes on the road. Say, how about this one? Show Wellington another watch and he says, Eddie, there's something missing on that watch. And you say, yes, I know. Things are so bad, I laid off one of the hands.
Well, kid, there's one thing about you. You always keep on punching.
I thought of another one. Listen to this one.
Hey, look out! Say, Davis, as a matter of self-protection, next week I want you to work for me at a salary as a writer. I'd rather hire you than be killed by you.
Thank you, Eddie Davis. Thank you. That was a strange beginning of a fine career. Letters from listeners. Each week we invite the listeners of Behind the Mic to write us questions about radio, and the 3 or 4 we consider to be of most general interest, we have answered on the air by the radio editor of some outstanding newspaper or magazine. Tonight's questions will be answered by Al Newman, radio editor of the magazine Newsweek. Mr. Philip M. Lewis of Salt Lake City writes in to ask, how does a sponsor tell whether his program is popular or not?
Well, Mr. Lewis, there are certain organizations that specialize in finding out the comparative popularity of programs. This is mostly done by taking a cross-section of various areas in the country and finding out by telephone what programs people are listening to at the moment and what programs they've listened to during the day. The sponsor can sometimes tell about the popularity of his program by the increase of the sale of his product since the program went on the air.
Miss Beulah Allison of New York City asks this. What is meant by the expression soap opera?
Soap opera, or soap saga, as it's sometimes called, is slang for a daytime radio serial. They're so called because so many of these serials are sponsored by large soap concerns.
Mr. William White of Saranac Lake, New York, writes in to ask, I have often heard the word stooge used as pertaining to a radio character. Will you please tell me exactly what a stooge is and how did the word originate?
Well, to take the last part of Mr. White's question first, there have been a great many explanations of the origin of stooge, but one of the most logical seems to be this. In the days when vaudeville was really vaudeville, and when an actor needed someone to say a few lines in his act, he'd sometimes hire an amateur to teach him how to deliver the lines, and maybe even how to sing a song. Such a person was called a student. Either through mispronunciation or carelessness, the word became stoogent, and was eventually shortened to stooge. Through the course of years, the term stooge became applied to a professional actor who played a subsidiary part in a vaudeville act. On the air, the term stooge is generally applied to a minor comedy character. Some famous stooges of radio have been Parky Carcass, Schlepperman of the Jack Benny program, Beadle of the Phil Baker program, and Tizzy Lish on the Al Pierce show.
Thank you, Al Newman. Thank you for answering those questions. How a radio broadcast helped save the life of a great football star. This past July, Ken Strong, former All-American football player and star of the New York football Giants, one of the greatest backs the game has ever produced, was deathly ill. But we'll let Ken tell it himself. Come on. He'll tell you about it. Ken Strong. Ken, exactly what was the matter with you?
Well, Graham, I had a bad case of stomach ulcers, and they had burst. I was operated on at the Flushing Hospital at 1 o'clock in the morning. The next night, I took a turn for the worse. I felt terrible. Not only physically ill, but mentally down. Not long before, my boy had a ruptured appendix. And that, and my own illness, weighed upon me. There were two people I kept asking for. My two closest friends, Stan Lomax, a sports writer and commentator, and Tim Mara, the owner of the Giants. About 3 o'clock in the morning, the doctor phoned Stan, and he said,
Hello, Mr. Lomax. Well, Ken is terribly sick. Now, what worries me most, though, is his mental condition. It just doesn't seem as if he cares to get well. And he's got to if he's going to pull through. He needs something to shock him into one to fight and live. Isn't there something you can do? I think you can.
Stan was a real friend, Graham. The next evening, when he went on the air for his regular sports broadcast, this is what he said.
Good evening, everyone. The greatest football player New York has ever produced, Ken Strong, is seriously ill at the Flushing Hospital. You've cheered him on the football field. Here's your chance to encourage him in something far more important, his fight for life. Write him and let him know that you're all pulling for him to win this biggest fight of all. Hello, Flushing Hospital. This is Herman Bagassi of Staten Island. Will you tell Ken Strong he's just got to get better and...
Say, operator, I'm a cop, and Strong don't know me, but you tell him that all the boys on the force are pulling for him to come through, and be sure and tell him that...
Say, what'll I do with these wires, miss? They're all for Ken Strong.
I'll have them brought up to his room. Oh, look at all these letters, Mr. Strong. Thousands of them from people who want you to get better.
Well, Graham, when I found how people were pulling for me, I felt if I didn't get better, I'd be letting them and my family, my friends, and everybody down. And I knew this was one touchdown I had to make.
You not only made it, Ken, but you knocked the Grim Reaper for a goal. And you're still with the New York Giants, of course.
Yes, I am, Graham. And if any of those people that wrote or phoned the hospital are listening, I'd like to personally thank them from the bottom of my heart.
Well, thank you. And the very best of luck to you, Ken Strong, and also to your New York Giants. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions about the inside of radio that you wish answered on the air, write a letter to us. Address it to Graham McNamee, Behind the Mic, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. As many questions as possible will be answered by mail, and the three or four questions we feel to be of most general interest will be answered on this program. Be sure to listen next week when we will bring you the inside story of football broadcasts, as told by Bill Stern and Swede Larson, coach of the Navy. What happened when a Zulu made his appearance on the radio broadcast? How radio brought help in the life and death crisis down in the Pacific Ocean? And more of the human interest, the glamour, the comedy, and the drama that are found behind the mic. This is Graham McNamee speaking. Good afternoon, all.
Gentlemen, if you have any questions about the inside of radio that you wish answered on the air, be sure and write a letter to us and address it to Graham McNamee, Behind the Mic, National Broadcasting Company, New York City. Now, all the questions, and as many as possible, will be answered by mail, and the three or four questions we feel to be of the most general interest will be answered on this program. Behind the Mic is written by Mort Lewis. Original music is composed and conducted by Ernie Watson. This is the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.